chapter 20. We'll be looking there this morning. If you are a fan of the Seattle Seahawks, you may or may not be familiar with the name Ben Malcolmson. Ben is the personal assistant to Pete Carroll, who's the head coach of the Seahawks. Now, Ben met Pete Carroll back when Pete was the coach of USC, and Ben was a student there. He worked on the student paper, and he was assigned the task of writing a story about the walk-on tryouts. Apparently, at USC, they provide the opportunity for any and all students who want to be on the team. They give them an invitation to come to try out, and if you do well enough, you get on the team. Now, in this case, most of those folks end up only ever playing on the practice squad, but in a few rare cases, they actually make the team proper. And so Ben thought, well, instead of writing the same old story about the tryouts, what I'm going to do is go and actually try out. Now, the irony of this is Ben had not played football but one year when he was 5 years old. So he didn't really know the rules of football, and he figured, I'll go, I'll try out, I'll make a fool of myself, and write a great story. And so he went, he tried out, he did in fact make a fool of himself, and he wrote his story. But to his surprise, he received a call from Pete Carroll saying, hey, you made the team. And so he sat there really thinking about this and praying about this, asking, okay, God, do you have something for me in this? And he just felt again and again that the Holy Spirit was nudging him to join the team because God had something for him in this. And so he joined the team, but in one of the very first practices, he ended up shattering his shoulder. And he was told that, you know, he would have to have surgery, and after surgery, he would be out for 9 months trying to recover from this. So the odds weren't great that he would ever make it back onto the football team. And so he went about the process, had surgery, went through rehab, but in a miracle of events, he was actually better, and so much better in 4 months, that they agreed to put him back on the team. And if he wasn't sure before that God had something for him in this, he was even more sure now. And so he decided the thing to do would be to have a Bible study and invite all of his teammates to come. And so he did this, and nobody came. And so he decided, okay, maybe that was a little too much. What I need to do is have a prayer group that's less intimidating. Maybe then people will come to that. And so he goes, invites his teammates, and has this, and nobody comes. So he decides, okay, I need to just build relationships one-on-one with people to become friends, to share the gospel that way, person to person. And so he goes about doing this. He creates these friendships with all of his teammates. In fact, he became one of the best-liked members of the team. And yet, none of those conversations ever really resulted in any sort of good gospel activity. And finally, he just felt, as Christmas was nearing, that God was impressing on his heart to give a Bible to each of his teammates. And so he contacted the Gideon Society and got a copy of the Bible for each and every teammate. And so, not being sure how this was going to go over, he snuck into the locker room and he put a Bible in each and every person's locker, including a note that said, Jesus Christ is the greatest gift
sometimes God calls us to do that, to share the gospel with people specifically in specific situations. Or sometimes it's the more general call, the call to love as Christ would have us. And yet, in a time like we're in today, where we can't even get along in the church, these are difficult calls. This is where we find the people of God in this story. They have been called by God to something, and it doesn't go well. So I will, as we read the word, invite you to stand out of reverence for it. Judges chapter 20, verse 1. And all Israel from Dan to Beersheba and from the land of Gilead came out, and the community assembled as one body before the Lord at Mizpah. The leaders of all the people and all the tribes of Israel presented themselves in the assembly of God. 400,000 armed foot soldiers, the Benjamites heard that Israel had gone up to Mizpah. The Israelites asked, "Tell us, how did this outrage occur?" The Levite, the husband of the murdered woman, answered, "I went to Gibeah in Benjamin with my concubine to spend the night. The citizens of Gibeah ganged up on me and surrounded the house at night. They intended to kill me, but raped my concubine and she died. Then I took my concubine and cut her in two pieces and sent her throughout Israel's territory because they committed a horrible shame in Israel. Look, all of you are Israelites, give your judgment and verdict here and now." Then all the people stood up and said, not one of us will go to his tent or return to his house. Now this is what we will do to Gibeah. We will go against it by lot. We will take 10 men out of every 100 of all the tribes of Israel, and 100 out of every 1,000, and 1,000 out of every 10,000, to get provisions for the people when they go to Gibeah in Benjamin to punish them for the horror they did in Israel. So all the men of Israel gathered, united against the city. Then the tribes of Israel sent men throughout the tribes of Benjamin, saying, "What is this outrage that has occurred among you? Hand over these perverted men in Gibeah so that we can put them to death and eradicate this evil from Israel." But the Benjamites would not listen or obey their fellow Israelites. Instead, the Benjamites gathered together from their cities to Gibeah to go out and fight against Israel. On that day, the Benjamites rallied 26,000 men from their cities, besides 700 choice men rallied from the inhabitants of Gibeah. There were 700 choice men who were left-handed among them, among all these people. All could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. The Israelites, apart from Benjamin, rallied 400,000 armed men, everyone an experienced warrior. They set out and went to Bethel and inquired of the Lord. The Israelites asked, "Who is to go first for us against the Benjamites?" And the Lord answered, "Judah will go first." In the morning, the Israelites set out and camped near Gibeah. The men of Israel went out to fight against Benjamin and took their battle positions against Gibeah. The Benjamites came out of Gibeah and slaughtered 22,000 men of Israel on the field of battle that day. But the Israel army rallied again and took their battle positions in the same place where they positioned themselves on the first day. They went up, wept before the Lord until evening, and inquired of him, "Should we go fight against our brothers, the Benjamites?" And the Lord answered, "Fight against them. On the second Israel army went to Bethel, where they wept and sat before the Lord. They fasted that day until evening and offered burnt offerings and fellowship offerings to the Lord. Then Israel inquired of the Lord. In those days, the Ark of the Covenant of God was there, and Phinehas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, was serving before it. Israel asked, should we go fight against our brothers, the Benjamites, or should we stop? And the Lord answered, fight, because I will hand them over to you tomorrow. And take a seat. So this story is the culminating story in the book of Judges. If you remember from last week, Rodney talked about this, how the people of Israel were called by God to go into the land and eradicate all the evil there. But they failed to do it. And so chapter 1 in Judges is all about how the people failed to do what God had called them to do, how they had failed to eradicate all the evil in Israel. In fact, they had settled with it. And by chapter 2 of Judges, what we find is the people of Israel are worshiping other gods. They're engaging in the very evil that God told them not to do, that God told them not to be a part of, to not settle with. Now, the overarching theme of the book of Judges is, in those days, there was no king, and everybody does what is right in their own eyes. God is not the king of his people. And we know this because in 1 Samuel, when the people are saying, we want a king, we want to be like all the other nations around us, God's response to that is to say to the prophet, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. In those days, there was no king, and everybody does what is right in his own eyes. And the results is chaos. Chapter 2 of Judges tells us the cycle of the book, where it is the people do evil, they worship other gods, they commit all kinds of horrible things, and so God turns them over to a captivity, and then eventually they realize their sin, they realize their error, they confess to God, and God raises up a judge to free the people. And at first, in chapter 3, we see this judge is a God-fearing judge. They worship Yahweh. They lead the people in the way of God. And then the next judge comes along who's just okay, still worshiping Yahweh, but not that great. And then comes a judge who doesn't even really know who Yahweh is. He worships one God and also Yahweh. And so the story continues as the judges get worse and worse and worse, to the point when you get to chapter 17 in the book, you're asking the question, who's really the good one here? Because the judges now have become so evil, they are doing evil just like all the other people. And this story particularly begins in chapter 19, where this Levite goes with his concubine to visit her father, and on the return, they decide to spend the night in Gibeah because Gibeah was of the tribes of Israel. And so they spend the night there, but all the men of the city come out and they want to abuse them, and they end up abusing this woman to the point of death. It is a very, very evil story. Evil to the point that Israel, while not walking with Yahweh, recognizes the heinousness of this evil. And so they come before the Lord and clearly are instructed, clearly are called. Yes, there's evil. They recognize that reality, and they are called to do something about it by God. In fact, he confirms it 3 times. And yet it doesn't go well. So the invitation of the text is to consider, what do we do when God calls us and it doesn't go well? And the first thing I would say, point number one, is we respond with the wisdom of Yahweh. You notice the first thing they do is all Israel assembles together before the Lord to seek God's wisdom on this. keep in mind, as the Proverbs tells us, there are two forms of wisdom. There is the wisdom of Yahweh. In fact, the Proverbs says, the fear of the Lord, that is the beginning of wisdom. Versus what is the other kind of wisdom? The wisdom of man, that wisdom which what? There's a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof is death. And so you see Israel coming before the Lord to seek his counsel. What should we do? How do we deal with this evil? And on the other side, you have Benjamin, which decides not to deal with the evil or recognize the evil. What do? They side with it. The wisdom of man is, these are our people. This is our group. This is what we want to do. And the result is death. In fact, to the tune of this, death affects the tribe of Benjamin long beyond this event. If you recall again in 1 Samuel, when the people ask for a king and God gives them a king, he is from what? The tribe of Benjamin, which is what? The smallest tribe of Israel. Why? Because of this. God ends up basically almost completely wiping out the tribe of Israel because of their evil. And so the invitation is, we respond with the wisdom of Yahweh, or we respond with the wisdom of man. Our second point this morning is, we keep away Yahweh even when it is hard. And we see the people doing this, even though these battles don't go well. What do you see them doing? Lining up yet again. God says, go and fight, and they go and fight. And they do this in prayer, first of all. They obey by praying. You see that in verse 18. You see that in verse 22. You see it in 27 and 28. They spend all this time going back, seeking God, seeking God, seeking God. I think it is easy for us when things do not go well and we say, well, I've been called by God to this. My natural response is that I need to work harder. I need to do more. I need to bring this about in my own power, in my own might. And yet, that is to fail to recognize that it is God who brings the victory. And so they obey by seeking God. They also obey by humbling themselves, by confessing, by repenting. You see that in verse 26, where it says the whole Israel army went to Bethel, where they wept and sat before the Lord. They fasted that day until evening and offered burnt offering and fellowship offering to the Lord. Then they inquired of the Lord. So we see them going and confessing and repenting of sin. And this is not an unusual or weird thing to do in light of the Old Testament. There are many points in the Old Testament where God withheld the victory from Israel. Why? Because of sin in their own camp. And so they deal with that sin, and it appears to me that the main sin here in this text is one of pride. Israel goes before the Lord, yes, but you notice they never ask God to bring the victory. They go to the Lord, but they never ask God to bring the victory. Why? Because they didn't really need God to do it. 400,000 beats 26,000. That is, the odds are 16 to 1. You're bound to win. So they come to the Lord recognizing they cannot do this on their own, in their own strength, by their own power. It is God who brings the victory for them. And that's what happens when God think there, we have to understand or recognize the reality that we do not see the view of God. We do not see the view of God. What appears to us to be failure is not necessarily failure. I like to say and think of it this way, there's a little bit of prosperity gospel in all of us. And that is to say, if God has called me to it, my expectation is it's going to go well. And yet, what we see is examples all over the Bible of times where people fully following the call of God do not meet that success. Think about some of these. For example, Joseph, he has these dreams, he has these visions from God that his family would be worshiping before him, and he didn't understand what it meant, but he knew that God was going to do something amazing in this story. And yet, you know how that story goes. He ends up getting sold as a slave. He spends time working in slavery till he's falsely accused, and then he goes to jail. And while he's in jail, he ends up getting forgotten in jail. Yet we know how that story ends. But Joseph saying, you, what you meant for evil, God meant for good. But if you were to ask Joseph in jail, where did you go wrong? He was following the call of God, and that led him to prison. But we know he did not. Or think of another example, the story of David, where David is out in the field minding his own business, tending to his sheep, and he gets called to the house, and an old dude pours oil on him and says, you're going to be the king of Israel. You think that's a great thing, right? But you know where that story goes as well. He ends up, as a result of this anointing, he loses his position, he loses his partner, he loses his peer, he loses his prophet, he loses even his pride. Because at one point in the story, where do we find David? We find him pretending to be crazy just to not be killed. And you can ask the question again, where did David go wrong? The best example of all, Jesus Christ, God, very God, take on human flesh to come for what? The purpose of doing what? Dying. As the book of Isaiah puts it, it was God's perfect will to crush him. Where did Jesus go wrong? About it that way, aren't you glad that God's call does not always go the way we think it should go or the way we want it to go, because Jesus' death and burial and resurrection brought about our reconciliation with God? We do not know how, we do not always see how God works, see how God moves. We left Ben Malcolmson in the locker room with the torn apart Bibles all over the floor. Well, fast forward that story 4 years later. Now Ben Malcolmson is the personal assistant of Pete Carroll. He is in Seattle working for the Seahawks. He's new to the city, so he wants to meet some people, wants to get connected in community, and he ends up meeting a guy who works for Young Life. And he's invited to come and be a part of Young Life, which reaches to and ministers to kids in primarily junior high and high school. And he decides that will be a great thing for him to do, an opportunity to meet some other leaders, but also an opportunity to invest in some kids. And so he goes to this Young Life meeting, and when he gets there, he's surprised to find one of his former teammates from this college football Bible is, what it's about. And so he says to him, it's a Bible. It's the story of Jesus. And this guy Mario says, well, what do we do with it? And he goes, well, you read it. The next day he comes in and Mario asks him, starts asking him questions about how you understand it, where you start to read it, what is Jesus really? I mean, all these great questions. Of course, Taylor doesn't know the answer to these, so he starts reading the Bible. And what ends up happening is apparently this guy Mario is so enthralled in what he's reading in the Word, he just continues to eat it up. In fact, his friend said anytime he was not practicing or playing football, he was reading that Bible. And he ends up accepting Jesus Christ as his personal Savior, and he does so 2 weeks before he dies in a tragic accident. He was out on a hike and apparently fell, or what they believe happened is he fell off the cliff edge and plummeted to his death. The result of all of this left this guy, Taylor, wrestling with the realities of God, the realities of life and death, the realities of eternity, and he himself ends up accepting Christ as well. It's a cool story in the end. Sometimes we get the opportunity to see what God is at work doing. Sometimes God gives us those glimpses into his glory. But a lot of the time, that's not necessarily the case. But we know that God is at work. In fact, in the book of Habakkuk, chapter 1, the prophet has been speaking to God, saying, God, you've got to deal with this evil. God, there is so much injustice going on. God, there is so much bad stuff happening. God, don't you see what's happening? And he goes on for 5 verses talking about all that is going on and all the things God needs to respond to. And then finally, God in verse 5 responds. He says, look at all the nations and observe. Be utterly astounded, for something is taking place in your day that you will not believe when you even hear about it. I love that verse. It's very encouraging. It's like, yeah, that's awesome. God is going to do something great. You know what God's next words are? For I am raising up the Chaldeans. Wait, hold up. Say what? That's not the answer the prophet wants. And yet God is saying, I am at work. I am doing something here. And so what does this all mean for us when God calls us to something and it doesn't go well? What do? We first of all recognize we need the wisdom of God. It's easy for us in a day, in an age, in an hour in which there are so many things clamoring for our attention, all these experts or all these possible approaches to everything. I could join up with my political friends here and, you know, hold to this position, or I could join these people over there and join that position, or get caught up in any of these things. The call, the charge is to remember there's only 2 kinds of wisdom. There's the wisdom of God or there's the wisdom of man, and we know where those end up. And so we seek the wisdom of Yahweh. We obey by continuing to do what God has called us to do, spending that time in prayer, saying, God, I don't know why this is happening. God, I don't know what is going to happen as a result of all this. Lord, it is hard. Lord, all I'm seeing is defeat. Lord, this is not what I signed up
this